Good morning, everyone. Okay.
Is this the one that needs the study notes?
We'll be back in the book of Job this morning, and we're going to cover a lot of ground this morning. As I indicated last time, we're not going to go through all of the dialogue that transpired between the three friends and Job. That would, I think, become very tiresome here in class. Much of it is repetitious, and so what I have tried to do for the study here is to capture one or two points in each one of the dialogues. And I put that as a highlight. I do want to encourage you to read those chapters. We're going to cover chapter 15 down through 31 this morning. And there are some very interesting things that are stated there, some very interesting things that come out. I've tried to capture what I think are the most important ones. And hopefully, as you study that as an entity, read it as one piece, you will gain some even deeper insights. For our passage this morning to kind of act as a capstone for our study, I want to have you turn to Job chapter 19, and we're going to read verses 23 through 27. Many Bible scholars and Bible students have noted that perhaps one of the most important or the most poignant passages in the book of Job is right here, Job chapter 19, verses 23 to 27. There, we could spend several weeks actually studying just this passage. We're going to spend just a brief amount of time on it this morning. It is worthy of much consideration, and I think there's a wealth of insight here. I'll try to just skim through what I have found, and hopefully you'll be able to see other things there as well. So I'd like to have somebody, if they would, volunteer to read Job chapter 19, verses 23 through 27. And the particular verse that we want to emphasize here is verse 25. So, Job 19, 23 through 27. Okay, Marilyn?
Oh, that my words were written. Oh, that they were inscribed in a book. That with an iron stylus and lead, they were engraved in the rock forever. As for me, I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will take his stand on the earth. Even after my skin is destroyed, yet from my flesh I shall see God, whom I myself shall behold, and whom my eyes shall see, and not another. My heart faints within me.
That's a very powerful passage, because as we have noted here before, Job was probably the first book that was written. We think Job was either slightly before Abraham or perhaps a contemporary of Abraham. He was not privy to the law. The law was not given until 400 years later. Most of the, in fact, all of the Old Testament was not written yet. So he had no written word of God. What he had was given by the Spirit of God and was given by what was handed down from generation to generation. So in verse 24 and verse 25, he makes an astounding statement. We need to make sure that we understand the context in which the passage is made. If you try to take this passage and put it into the New Testament, all of us would say, well, of course this is true. But he didn't know that. I mean, he couldn't turn to 1 Thessalonians and turn to 2 Thessalonians or turn to the book of the Revelation and say, well, of course this is true. How did he know this? In verse 25, he says, I know that my Redeemer lives. That is an astounding statement. I know that my Redeemer lives. Now, the words that are in this passage in the Hebrew are very difficult to translate. And the only thing we can really do to get the meaning is to take the words that are used in the Hebrew and compare them with other Old Testament passages where the same word is used. And from that we can glean what is very likely the direct meaning of this particular word. There are two things in verse 25, and I'm kind of getting a little bit ahead of myself here, but in verse 25 it is emphatic in the word no. The word no means I assuredly, absolutely, and positively 100% convinced. I know it. I know that my Redeemer lives. We talked a little bit last time, last class, about faith. We looked at Hebrews 11. Now, faith is the evidence of things not seen. For me, my faith has transitioned from believing something to knowing something. And I hope that your faith is the same way. I hope that you have gotten your faith from just believing something to knowing it. I sometimes feel almost embarrassed to say that I have faith, because in the world today, to say that you have faith is almost like, well, you believe in something that you can't prove. You believe in something that is not demonstrable. You have taken that step into the unknown. I know my Redeemer lives. I know that more assuredly than I know that chair is here. I know it. Do you understand what I'm saying? I know it. That's what Job said back here. He said, and in the Hebrew this is emphatic, I know my Redeemer lives. I hope you can say that this morning. I hope in your heart you can settle back and say, I don't care. I just know it. That's what Job said. And how did he know that? He knew it the same way you and I know it today, folks. The Spirit of God bears witness with our spirit. The Spirit of God bears witness with our spirit. There's no other way. There's no other way to explain it. There's no other way to know it. You know it because He reveals it to you. Well, that was the commercial. Let's go back and start at chapter 15. And in chapter 15, we're going to look at the what I call the verbal jousting. What happens here with these three friends? The three friends come, and they come, I believe, initially with pure motives. I believe they come because Job was their friend. They had heard about the misery and the trial that had beset him, and they generally came to comfort him. I mean, they made a long journey. They went out of their way. They did this. I believe their initial motives were very good. Their initial motives, however, soon fell apart, because what they saw in Job was a man who was going through such enormous suffering that they had to somehow or other try to explain it. They just had to fit it into their theology. And they had a very clear theology of how God operates. And their theology, we have already talked about, is corrupt. So, when we start in chapter 15, we're going to consider the discussion, the second discussion that his friend Eliphaz gives to him. And Eliphaz continues to restate his corrupt theology. And what is it? Look at chapter 15, and we'll look at verses 17 through 20. Chapter 15, verse 17 through 20. I will tell you, listen to me, and what I have seen I will also declare, what wise men have told and have not concealed from their fathers, to whom alone the land was given and no alien passed among them. The wicked man writhes in pain all his days, and numbered are the years stored up for the ruthless. What did he just say there? What I have seen, it's been handed down. I have this great wisdom. I have observed this. This is true. The wicked writhe in pain. That's and Job is doing is what? Writhing in pain. Therefore, Job, you are bad. You are bad. Job must be shaking his fist at God. Let's look at verse 25. Chapter 15, verse 25. Because he has stretched out his hand against God. This is a description of this wicked man. He has stretched out his hand against God and conducts himself arrogantly against the Almighty. And Job, this is obviously a description of you. You have spoken arrogantly. You have stretched out your hand. And then look at verse 31 through 35. Let him not trust in emptiness, deceiving himself. Now, keep in mind that Job, where is Job physically? He's in the dump. He's in the city dump. He's scraping himself with broken pieces of pottery. He is oozing sores. He is in ashes. He is in misery. It says later on that his skin is turning black and peeling and falling off. He is emaciated. He has lost weight. He's down to, he can't eat. He can't keep anything down. He is just skin and bones. Here is this man who is just wretched. And his friends who are enjoying good health and robust health, and they have come to help him. And they have come to help him. Now I want you to listen to verse 31. Let him not trust in emptiness, deceiving himself. And he's talking, Eliphaz here is talking about this wicked man. Okay? Let him not trust in emptiness, for emptiness will be his reward. It will be accomplished before his time, and his palm branch will not be green. He will drop off his unripe grape like the vine, and will cast off his flower like the olive tree. For the company of the godless is barren, and fire consumes the tents of the corrupt. They conceive mischief and bring forth iniquity, and their mind prepares deception. Job, do you hear this? So, your plight, the plight that you are in, Job, comes only to the most wicked. And they came, and I believe they heard that Job was suffering, but then when they saw him, they were just stricken. They were just amazed at his suffering, and so by their theology, if there was such great, great suffering, there had to be what? Great, great sin. Well, what is Job's reply in chapter 16, verses 1 through 5? And Job answered, I've heard many such things. Sorry comforters are you all. Is there no limit to windy words? I love that. Is there no limit to windy words or what plagues you that you answer? I too could speak like you if I were in your place. Now what did he just say there? If we could
reverse
the roles here, I would have a different story and so would you. And boy, there's a lot of truth in that. There's a lot of truth in that. I would speak like you if I were in your place. I could compose words against you and shake my head at you. I could strengthen you with my mouth and the solace of my lips could lessen your pain. I could do that. But you haven't done that. You haven't helped me. You haven't come alongside and comforted me in any way, shape, or form. All you have done since you got here is tell me what a wretched person I am. So, what is Job's reply? If the tables were turned, this would be a different story. We'd have a different discussion here. And what is Job's real faith? Look at verses 19 through 21. Even now, behold, my witness is in heaven. Now that, again, is a passage in the Hebrew that's a little bit difficult to understand. But basically, what he is saying here seems to be that my witness, the witness who will witness for me, is located where? In heaven. Now that is also a deep insight for Job. Remember, a couple weeks ago we talked about, he said, you know, if there were just an intercessor, one who stood between, one who could put his hand on me and one who could put his hand on God and stand between us, that would then that would be good. And so in verse 19, he says, even now behold my witness is in heaven and my advocate is on high. An advocate is a legal term. It's a term for a lawyer. One who is a representative in a courtroom. My friends are my scoffers. My eye weeps to God. Oh, that a man might plead with God as a man with his neighbor. For when a few years are past, I shall go the way of no return. So he's looking at this and saying, you know, it's just going to end. And then look at chapter 17, verses 1 through 5. My spirit is broken. I believe this is Job kind of pouring out his heart. I think he's just laying himself bare here in front of his friends. And he says, my spirit is broken. We don't know for sure what the timeline is in the book of Job. It's not, but not only do we not know at what time historically the whole event takes place, we don't know the length of it. It appears as though Job was many days, probably months in this condition, perhaps even before his friends got there. They sat silent for 10 days, so that went on for that, and then for the balance, probably the balance of a month. And he says, by this point, my spirit is broken. My days are extinguished, and the grave is ready for me. What's he saying there? He says, there's no question in my mind what Satan had smitten him with as a disease was a degenerative disease, and it was progressing, and he was getting worse and worse every day, and he could see it, and everyone around him could see it, and he knew that it was just a matter of time. He had given up. Surely mockers are with me, and my eye gazes on their provocation. Lay down now a pledge for me with yourself. Who is there that will be my guarantor? For thou hast kept their heart from understanding, therefore thou wilt not exalt them. He who informs against his friends for a share of the spoil, the eye of his children also shall languish. Job is just at the end of his rope. He says, my intercessor is in heaven. There is one in heaven who is going to be my witness. but my fate is the grave. I am near it and getting nearer every day. And so then we enter the next friend being Bildad. And Bildad now comes along and refreshes their corrupt theology. We find this in chapter 18, verses 1 through 21, actually the whole chapter. I'll just read, skim through parts of this for you. Then Bildad the Shuhite responded, "How long will you hunt for words? Show understanding and then we can talk. Why are we regarded as beasts, as stupid in your eyes?" You can notice here as the passage drags on that the relationship between Job and the friends has become very adversarial, right? Job sees them as being not helpful at all, and they see Job as being despicable. Just despicable. And so the words here, just kind of flow from that. He talks indeed about the wicked. Indeed, the light of the wicked goes out. Job has just said, "I don't see anything in my future except the grave." And what does Bildad say? "Indeed, the light of the wicked goes out, Job. And the flame of his fire gives no light. The light in his tent is darkened and his lamp goes out above him. His vigorous stride is shortened and his own scheme brings him down, for he is thrown into the net by his own feet and he steps on the webbing. A snare seizes him by the heel and a trap snaps shut on him." Boy, this is good, isn't it? These words are just... this is a Pulitzer Prize. And all around him, terrors frighten him and harry him at every step. And who is to him that this is happening to?
Job.
In the passage, it's the wicked, right? And the analogy is, it's Job. You're exactly right, it's Job. His strength is famished, calamity is ready at his side. The third, verse 13, his skin is devoured by disease. Oh, isn't that an interesting observation? The skin of the wicked is devoured by disease. The firstborn of death devours his limb. There dwells in his tent nothing of his. Verse 15, brimstone is scattered on his habitation. Oh, Job, you are a miserable lot. That's just the Archer paraphrase. So Bildad describes vividly the fate of the wicked, and it's clearly intended to describe Job. And somebody has rightly said, if you have friends like this, you don't need enemies. And that's a sad commentary. But it is often the case. It has been said and observed that Christians are the only ones who shoot their wounded. And there is a tendency. There's a self-righteous tendency amongst believers to bring judgment and condemnation upon those who fall into trial. And I believe that even when it happens today, it is a manifestation, perhaps not quite as blatant. Sometimes it is quite as blatant. Perhaps not quite as blatant as exactly what is happening here in the book of Job. These friends have a theology that basically says God always blesses good people and he always condemns bad people here and now, right now, and if you are suffering, it is because you deserve it. That's their theology. Well, here we come with this foremost statement made by Job in the midst of his trial, chapter 19, verses 25 through 27. I know, and I put that in italics because it is emphatic in the Hebrew, I know that my Redeemer lives. He will stand on the earth and I myself will see him. The language here is very interesting. It is difficult. Linguists have studied this, and there are multiple interpretations, but it all comes down to this. I mean, after you strip away all of the various renderings, it all comes down to this. Job says, in effect, I'm going to go into the grave. My flesh is wasting away. It's all going to turn into dust. But my Redeemer lives, and He is going to stand on this earth, and I will see Him with my own eyes. Not somebody else's. I will see Him with my own eyes. Now, the question that we are left with in this, theologically, is whether or not Job understood the resurrection. And the truth of the matter is, there is no indication elsewhere in the book that either Job or his friends anticipated or knew of the resurrection. That was a startling thing to me, to realize that that was true in the book of Job. And what it tells me again is how incredibly blessed you and I are. You understand how much He has given to us? How much He has told? Suppose, let me just suppose for a minute. Let me suppose that you did not know that there was going to be a resurrection. How would it change you? Wow. That's a biggie. That's a biggie. And I don't know whether Job understood that or not. I mean, there's theologians on both sides of this argument that have blunted a lot of swords trying to prove that he did or that he didn't. And you can't tell from this passage. It is impossible to tell from this passage whether he did or didn't. But if you look at the rest of the book and take it as a whole, my conclusion is he didn't. Yes?
Job feels that he is righteous before God. And God has said he is righteous. Yet he calls out and says he has a redeemer. Why does he feel he needs a redeemer?
That's a good question. And Vaughn, one of the things that is so interesting about this word redeemer and the fact that he knows it is redeemer, the closest connection that we have to the exact same word redeemer is from the book of Ruth. You remember when we studied in the book of Ruth and we had this kinsman redeemer? It was one who went to buy back something that had previously been lost. And that's exactly what the word means. It is the exact same word here. So he is saying, I know that there is a Redeemer who has redeemed me, and He lives. And I just say, wow, that's amazing. It's amazing. And yet, it isn't. It isn't, because I believe the Spirit of God does that. Marilyn?
Well, he also knows that there's going to be a judgment, because in verse 29, he said, be afraid of the sword for yourself, for wrath brings the punishment of the sword, so that you may know there is judgment.
Yep, yep. And we're going to talk about that in just a minute. But he really does. He lays it down. His response to his three friends is pretty severe. He lays it down and says, look, if you believe all this, you ought to be shaking in your boots, because you're no better than me.
The NIV defines redeemer as defender.
Defender is a good, it's a term that's used, Bob, in a courtroom. In a courtroom situation, in a legal case, it can be a defender. It's sometimes translated as a witness. It is most usually translated as the redeemer who buys back. So it has a flavor of all of those things. So he says, I know my Redeemer lives, and he will stand on the earth, and I myself will see him. And how did he know that? I don't know. And then what Marilyn has just pointed out, What prophetic warning does Job give to his friends in chapter 19, verses 28 and 29? Let's read those together. If you say, how shall we persecute him, and what pretext for a case against him can we find? Then be afraid of the sword for yourself, for wrath brings the punishment of the sword, so you may know there is judgment. What he is saying here is, I believe, what underneath terrifies these three friends. They know Job. The description that was given of Job in chapter 1 and chapter 2, that wasn't just something that was known in heaven. Everybody knew it. Job was a good, righteous man. He helped the poor. He helped the widows. He fed the hungry. I mean, he was doing it all. And I think they're looking at Job and saying, yikes. If our theology is right, and he doesn't make it, and that is just exactly what Job says right here. If you really believe my root problem is in myself, in other words, if you believe that this is coming on me because of what a horrible person I am, then you ought to what?
Look out.
You ought to be scared out of your boots because you're no better than me. Now, their position as they came to Job was simply, Job, you deserve this. You're in this wretched state, and it only happens to the wicked, and hasn't happened to us. And Job's point is,
yet.
You say, if you really believe that the root problem that I'm having is because of my terrible sin, then you better be scared, because you're no better than me. Well, okay, so Eliphaz and Bildad have had their shot. So let's look at the next one. What does Zophar repeat? Chapter 20, verses 1 through 29. Zophar the Naamite answered, therefore my disquieting thoughts make me respond, even because my inward agitation, I listen to the reproof which insults me, and the spirit of my understanding makes me answer. Do you know this from of old, from the establishment of man on the earth, that the triumphing of the wicked is short and the joy of the godless momentary? Job, you know this. Everybody knows this. It is clear and obvious. Wicked people only survive for a short period of time. Though his loftiness reaches the heavens and his head touches the clouds, he perishes forever like his refuse. Those who have seen him will say, where is he? He flies away like a dream and they can't find him, even like a vision of the night. He is chased away. It's all he's saying here is the same thing that the other two have been saying right along. Job, the wicked always perish. The wicked always are judged in this earth here and now. And you are suffering incredible. You have got to be a wicked person. This has got to be God's judgment on you for your wicked sin. Now, we know from chapter 1 and chapter 2 that what was falling on Job was not because of his sin, but what? Because he was righteous. God held him up, and Satan said, yeah, well, I'll show you what he's really like. You just let me at him. So Job was not suffering because God was angry with him for his sin. He was suffering because he was righteous. Well,
Bill, is Satan using these three friends to be part of the problem?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Huge.
I mean, the sores were bad. The losing of his family was awful, and all of his wealth But somehow this berating on and on and on,
yep,
to me is worse than any of the other punishment. Because, yeah, you might think, okay, I've lost everything, but I still have my character. I still,
yep,
have my,
yep,
you know, the inner me, and they're attacking that. And I don't know about other people, but if people attack my name, that hurts me far more than,
yeah,
anything else,
yeah,
in the world.
I believe exactly as Marianne has said. I believe that the attack of these three friends is not coincidental. It's not accidental. I believe it is a coordinated part, and in fact, the coup de grace of Satan, as he has attacked Job. He has hit him with everything that the Lord will allow him to do, short of taking his life. That has not caused him to collapse, but this very well could. This attack is a verbal attack by your friends. His wife has already,
yeah,
has already given him up. Her counsel to him was, curse God and just die, you know? Well, that helps a lot. And then his three friends come in, and all they do is tell him how wicked and terrible he is, and I believe, I agree absolutely with Marianne. I believe that if Job could scale all of the trials that have happened so far, I think this is the hardest. Mm-hmm. I think this is the hardest thing is to have those whom you love and those whom you trust to turn on you. And by the way, that's exactly what happened to Christ, is it not? Jesus was the shepherd, and the scripture says, I will smite the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. And even the disciples wouldn't stand by him. Peter denied him, said, I don't know the man. You don't, I think that drove something. Jesus had nurtured and walked with Peter for 3 years. He was his friend. They had done things together. He was the Lord. And here is Peter standing up and saying, I never knew him. Whoa. Those words. And is this coincidental? This attack? Oh, I don't think so. Well, what obvious truth does Job point out in chapter 21, verses 1 through 34? And I want you to notice, let's look at 27 through chapter 21. Let's go drop down to 27. 27 through 33, and then we'll look at verse 34. Starting at verse 27. Behold, I know your thoughts and the plans by which you would wrong me, for you say, where is the house of the nobleman, and where is the tent, the dwelling places of the wicked? Have you not asked wayfaring men, and do you not recognize their witness? For the wicked is reserved for the day of calamity. They will be led forth at the day of fury. Who will comfort him with his actions, and who will repay him for what he has done? While he is carried to the grave, men will keep watch over his tomb. The clods of the valley will gently cover him. Moreover, all men will follow after him, while countless ones go before him. Now, what is he saying in this passage? What Job is saying is the same thing that the psalmist said many, many years later. I don't understand. When I look out at this world, I see the wicked, and I see the wicked prosper. I don't understand. Now, that's sort of the corollary of this. This situation is, I see the righteous and I don't understand why they suffer. The corollary of it is, I see the wicked and I don't understand why they prosper. Now see, this is the piece of the equation that Job's three friends were just absolutely ignoring. I don't see that. Do you see that? All I see is that God always judges the wicked. And Job says, no, wait a minute. You know that's not true. You know there are wicked people who are prosperous and go to their grave in peace.
Yeah.
You know that that's true. And then he says in verse 34, how then will you vainly comfort me, for your answers remain full of falsehood? Your arguments don't hold water. You're not even paying attention to the truth that is around you. And I would just suggest to you, that's one of the things that is true about all bad theology. All bad theology has to have a blind side. You just have to say, I don't see that. I ignore that. I refuse to acknowledge that that exists. And if I don't acknowledge that it exists, it's not there, therefore my theology is right. And that's basically what they had done. They had just closed their eyes to the fact that there were wicked people who basically said, I will have nothing to do with God. And they prospered. And they went to their grave in peace. And Job said, hey, guys, what are you going to do with this?
I don't know how you know that. I don't know. How can you say that for sure?
Oh, he's only observed... Good point. I wasn't clear on this. They, as far as human perception is concerned, he looked at people who had wealth and who had riches and who had good things in this earth, and they appeared to live prosperously and to die prosperously. He said, I see that. Now see, that was exactly what their friends were saying. What his friends were saying. He said, his friends were saying, that's never the case. God always judges the wicked. And Job says, no, it's not. It's not that way. And we see it today. You and I see cases today where there are people who are just plain anti-God. Now, does that mean that there is no judgment, that they're getting away with this? Oh, absolutely not, because there is coming a judgment. So there is another judgment, but this is not talking about that other judgment. This is talking about what's right here and now today. That's all they seem to have, as all they knew about, I think. What is the summary of Eliphaz's next dissertation, chapter 22, verses 21 through 30. We'll look at verses 21 through 23. Chapter 22. Eliphaz, you remember, is the first one to speak. He is the oldest of the group. And starting at verse 22, he says, please receive instruction from his mouth and establish his words in your heart. If you return to the Almighty, you see that? If you return to the Almighty. Now, what is the obvious assertion? You ain't. You ain't. If you return to the Almighty, you will be restored. You will be restored. If you remove unrighteousness far from your tent and place your gold in the dust and the gold, you are a money... They are just unrelenting in kicking him while he's down. And I want you to notice that is really Satan's theology. It's just repackaged a little bit.
Bill, that's still true today, isn't it? Oh. Many pastors, many churches still teach prosperity. You love the Lord God, and money will come to you. Prosperity
yep.
will come to you. Money will come into your
yep.
lives. That's the total purpose of coming to God, yep. it seems, in some ministries, is that you will enjoy the benefits of money here, success, all that's going to happen to you.
Health, wealth, and happiness.
Right. So
it is. We have some people that we know in our time that have made major ministries totally based on that assumption. And it's a popular idea. I mean, if somebody is telling you and teaching you that if you will just do this, God will bless you, it's like a vending machine. It's like a formula, you know. Do this, put the quarter in the machine, God will bless you. That's their theology, folks. And where did their theology come from? Chapter 1, verses 6 through 11, who did it come from?
Satan.
It came from Satan. This is Satan's theology. This is what Satan is foisting on this world today. It is a works-oriented theology, and it is to love God for what you get, not for who He is. You and I are often guilty of presenting the gospel in that fashion. We should present the gospel as loving God because He is worthy, because He deserves our worship, not because if you love God, He will bless you. That may or may not be true. You love God because He is worthy, because He is God, because He has created you. Well, what is Job's repeated request in chapter 23, verses 1 through 5? He comes up with this again. He says, even today my complaint is rebellion. His hand is heavy despite my groaning. Oh, that I knew where I might find Him, that I might come to His seat. I would present my case before Him and my mouth and fill my mouth with arguments. I would learn the words which He would answer and perceive what He would say to me. This is not one of Job's finer moments. What is he saying here?
God owes me an answer.
God owes me an answer. That's an excellent summary. God owes me an answer. If I knew where I could find God, if I knew where He lived, I would go and demand that He give an answer to me. Not one of Job's finer moments. Linda and I were talking this week, and I've been reading through, and I hope you have been reading through also. Read through the book of Job, just as casual reading, not necessarily just studying, but just read it, just listen to what is said. And I got to tell you this: Job's words at times are unbelievably horrible. They are unbelievably horrible. If you just go through and read all the chapter headings that says, and Job answered, just go through and read those sequentially. Job says things that are absolutely horrific. In essence, Job says, God has violated my rights. God is guilty. And if I could get Him into court, I would prove my case. And I just think, you know, why does God tolerate that? And I want you to think about that question. Why does God tolerate this with Job? And I think there are a lot of potential answers. I don't have the answer, but I want you to think about that, and we'll talk about it in a couple weeks here. So his repeated request, and this happens over and over again as you read through each one of the chapters, Job said, Job replied, you'll find that he keeps asking for this. I want to be in court with God. I want to prove Him wrong. And in chapter 24, verse 1, it just says, God is just avoiding this time. He's avoiding me. He won't answer my prayers. If I had my way, I'd put Him in court and I'd make Him answer. Now, the three friends see that as being blasphemous. And I'm not sure I'm too far from that myself. So Bildad's response to Job's continuous stance that he is righteous in chapter 23, verses 1 through 5. Then Job replied, even today, my complaint is rebellion, his hand is heavy. I got
25.
25.
Then Bildad the Shuhite answered, "Dominion and awe belong to him who establishes peace in his heights. Is there any number to his troops, and upon whom does his light not rise? How then can a man be just with God? Or how can he be clean who is born of a woman? If even the moon has no brightness, and the stars are not pure in his sight, how much less a man, that maggot, and the son of man, that worm?" And so his response, Job has just said, "I'm righteous, I'm right, I am right, God has wronged me," and Bildad's response is what? "You're wrong. You're wrong. No man who is born of a woman, born under sin, no man is going to be righteous before God." Now, the fact of the matter is, that's true. And Job has overstepped. He has overstepped his bounds. Can you scroll that back up? I think.
Bill, while Mark's doing that, would you help me a little bit? I'm having
next page. Yeah, okay. Put this right at the top of the screen. Okay.
In chapter 23, when he starts out discouraged, or however, but as he continues to talk, starting in verse 10, "But he knows the way I take, and he has tested me, come forth as gold, my foot's held the step," and then he goes on, "neither have I gone back from the commandment of his lips, and I have treasured his words." I mean, I don't see this as failure. I see this as a human person that was discouraged and yet comes back to saying, "And yet, in spite of this frustration of mine, I'm still trusting in God's word."
I think that's exactly the case. One of the things, and Marianne has kind of answered part of the question as to why God has been and is tolerant to Job. And one of the things that I think happens here is that Job, you have to remember his circumstances. Job is under incredible, incredible trial and stress. And God is not blind to that. He understands Job's stress, and one of the things that happens with Job is that he will continuously talk about putting God on trial and all this kind of stuff, but then he will switch back and he will say, "But I know my Redeemer lives. And I know I will see him." In other words, there is that faith that is there, and sometimes it just breaks out and just shines. And I think that's the difference. Okay. That's the difference.
Human in him, we all feel that way.
Sometimes, you know, when you are in the midst of the trial, it is not always as easy as it ought to be. It seems like it ought to be a lot clearer. Especially to those of us who know the truth, and yet when you are in the heat of the moment, you can cave in. You can cave in. And I think that's what happens to Job at times.
Well, for those of us who know where this is going at the end of Job and his repentance, I thought about, Bill, what you were saying, and two things come to mind. One is, Christ said on the cross, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Even he had that human frailty.
Yep.
Why have you forsaken?
Yep.
But then I think about the notion of probably our favorite song. It's called Footprints in the Sand. And when I think about the fact that all of us in here, like Joe, are sinners, and all of us, on occasion, an event has happened in our life and we've said, "God, why did you allow this to happen to a good person like me? Why did you allow this to happen to a good person like that person? God, why have you forsaken me?" And we must remind ourselves constantly that he is always there for us.
Yep.
And that we are sinners.
Yep. And one of the things that we can do in that sense is to remember that God is always there for us. We can turn to the scriptures and pick out promises and passages that say that is true, but Job didn't have that.
I think sometimes, though, we forget that people just get tired. I remember many years ago, my family went through a really, my dad was killed in an accident, my mother's traumatized for life, and I still remember thinking every day I was supposed to be a witness to the people who were in that trauma center and who were in that waiting room, and I still remember, on day eight, I'd had it. You know, I was just all worn out. I was done being a good person, a good Christian. You know, and I'm sure that those people thought, you know, what? Oh my gosh, you know, what Christian could do this? But you just get tired, you know, of feeling like you have to be there and be the witness for everyone else, while you really need to be witness too.
Yeah. And one of the things that is important to understand here, and one of the reasons why I tried to study this in the method that I did, is looking at how the Lord addresses this whole situation and then looking at what was said. You already know that how the Lord addresses this situation. When the Lord answers Job and his three friends, he spends the better part of three chapters addressing whom? Job. Addressing Job. Does he condemn him? No, but he straightens him out. He straightens him out. And then when he comes to his three friends, what happens there? That's a little different story there. Well, let's go quickly through this. How does Job really feel about the comfort from his three friends? Chapter 26, 1 through 4. This is, and Job responded, "What a help you are to the weak. How you have saved the arm without strength. What counsel you have given to the one who has no wisdom. What helpful insight you have abundantly provided. To whom have you uttered words? And whose spirit was expressed through you? Where did you get this great wisdom?" So how does he feel about their counsel? Not so much. Not so much. But what incredible charge is made against God, and this is coming from Job in chapter 27, verses 1 and 2, and Job says this again. "Then Job continued his discourse and said, 'As God lives, who has taken away my right, and the Almighty, who has embittered my soul, for as long as life is in me and the breath of God is in my nostrils, my lips certainly will not speak unjustly, nor will my tongue utter deceit. He has wronged me, and I am righteous. But while man has discovered many things," in chapter 28, and he talks about mining and all kinds of wondrous things, what really counts in chapter 28, verses 20 through 28, and when we finish that, "And to man he said, Behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding." Job understood that. And as a matter of fact, those words are repeated almost exactly in the Psalms. Psalm 111, verse 10, and Proverbs chapter 8, verse 13, are two of them amongst many that say, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of the wisdom." After Job reflects on what he has lost, which is chapters 29, 30, and 31, he just laments everything that he's lost. He says, "I've lost my honor, I've lost my family, I've lost my health, I've lost all my wealth, I've lost everything. I used to be respected, now everybody just wags their tongue at me. Even little kids come and throw stones at me. It's just, you know, I am totally bereft of anything." And what does he reason? He says, "I am guiltless. I would approach God in court like a prince. And if I'm not clear, then let it be." Job, those words are terrible. Job, why did you say that? And I say to myself, Bill, why did you say that? And I'm so thankful that God is gentle and long-suffering and understanding.
You know, what's amazing is through all this, Job never thinks, "Are these guys right?"
Actually, and that is exactly the case. So after days of verbal jousting, we don't know how long this took, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. After days of verbal jousting, what happens? I want you to look at chapter 32. Chapter 32. So we've had this back and forth. You are wretched. You are unbelievably wicked. No, I'm not. I'm righteous. I'm totally righteous. Back and forth. Then these three men ceased answering Job because he was what? Because he was righteous in his own eyes. But the anger of Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite, of the family of Ram, burned. Against Job his anger burned because he justified himself before God, and his anger burned against his three friends because they had found no answer and yet had condemned Job. And all God's people said, "Who's this? Who's this? Elihu? This is a fourth character. We had Job and his three friends, and we thought that was it. But it is obvious that there is another person who is there, and it is a young person, and his name is Elihu, and he has listened to this back and forth, back and forth. I am righteous. Oh, you are a sinner." Back and forth, back and forth. He's listened to it for days now. And finally, after the end, he has concluded, nobody's given up here. Nobody's changed anybody's mind. The three friends are just as stuck in their position as they were. Job is just as stuck in his position as he was. They didn't convince anybody of anything. And he stands up and says, "I'm ticked at all of you." Well, who is this guy? And what is his conclusion? We'll study that next time. And I would encourage you to read chapter 32 and a few chapters more and just get a picture of Elihu, and we'll talk about him, Lord willing, next time. Lord, thank you so much for this good day and for your grace. Thank you for this study and for the privilege of having the Word of God in our hands. Lord, may you bless us as we go our separate ways, and should you tarry, bring us back together again so that we might worship and fellowship together in Jesus' name. Amen. Have a good day.
For those of you that contributed this offering for Corbin, we gathered up a